Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this show, we halt one of rock's big beasts at the gates of return in the shape of Pink Floyd's new-ish album. We quiz local artist Carl Rudziak on the power of the portrait and his forthcoming community project that tests how we value our culture. We also consider the place of dad rock and the re-emergence of nostalgic marketing, as well as pick over some top events for you to check out locally. With me, as always, is the crazy diamond that continues to shine, the Pompey Piper at the Gates of Dawn, the other lost fish in the fishbowl. It's Dave Allen.
Nice to be here, James.
Good to see you again, Dave. And tonight, straight from last year's Audio Technica Record Store of the Year 2013, and one of The Guardian's top 10 independent record stores in the UK, it's Steve and Rad.
Thanks for that, James, yeah.
Yeah, I was just bigging you up there.
And lovely introduction.
It's great to get you into the studio. It's really nice to see you. And I want to describe the beards first. We have mass beard in the studio, I think. Don't get too close because there'll be a Velcro.
Yeah.
We're going to start tonight by talking about, I think, possibly one of the biggest releases of the year. And that's an ambitious thing to say, but we're talking about the return of Pink Floyd. They've been away for a long time. Things have happened. Things have changed to their lineup, which we're going to talk about. But this is a new release for them, a new studio album. In fact, their 15th studio album. It's called The Endless River. It was released on the 10th of November on Parlophone. And it's a very strange record in some ways because it's new and old. And I alluded to that in the introduction. 60% of this album was recorded this year in 2014, with around 40% of it being recorded in 1993. The Endless River itself, that phrase is part of a lyric from the song High Hopes, which I think was the last track on the Division Bell, which was their last proper studio album. And that's a link, really. That's a bridge to where this album comes from. It's a lot of offcuts, and that doesn't do it justice to say that they're offcuts, but it's a lot of experimentation, a lot of material that they recorded in early 1993 from some jam sessions around that album. So it has Dave Gilmour, Nick Mason and Richard Wright on the album, although Richard Wright sadly passed away in 2008. And they recorded in 1993 over 100 pieces of music, and they refined some of those pieces to become the Division Bell album. And all of the other pieces they used and reworked and tried to fit into this album. They've suggested it's a return to their previous kind of creative process and back to their basic way of creating a Pink Floyd album. And there are a lot of, I think it's fair to say, and we'll start with this, there are a lot of keyboard elements in this album. It's really quite a keyboard-heavy album, I think. And that is partly, I think, a nod to Richard Wright. But Dave Allen has been locked away in his Anderson shelter that he has somewhere on the Hot Walls beach, listening on his radiogram to The Endless River. Dave, what did you make of it? We'll start with you, because I think of all of us, you're the most well-listened on this one.
Yeah, I am. I guess it's worth saying, we often say this, that this is a pre-recorded show, so by the time this goes out, the album will have been out for 2 weeks, but it's actually been out for about 12 hours, or I've had it for about 12 hours. I got up this morning and downloaded it and sat typing, because I had typing to do, and listened, and I just had it on loop, so I played it for about 3 hours. Now, I will confess to being, once upon a time, a big fan of the first, what I would call the first two phases of Pink Floyd, which was, first of all, the Syd Barrett phase, because I think he was a wonderful songwriter, and then the early Gilmour stuff, when they were to a large extent, a kind of psychedelic space age instrumental group, and I liked those two phases. And then I increasingly found them tedious, and by about 1975, almost never listened to anything they did after that.
They became a bit indulgent, didn't they, I think,
I mean, I don't mind if other people did like them, but they weren't for me at all. And what intrigued me about this, I came to it with some trepidation, thinking, I'm not really not, you know, you'd set the agenda, I'm really not sure that I want to listen to it, but what I found was that it was almost wholly reminiscent of my phase two, the early Gilmore stuff, and delightfully devoid of songs, because I thought Syd Barrett for me was one of the great English songwriters. You know, he stands alongside Ray Davies as a songwriter about England. But once he'd gone, I wasn't terribly fond of the songs, so I didn't mind that there's an absence of songs. It kind of meanders. You know, you could see it as somewhat self-indulgent. There, you know, and the reviews of it are absolutely fascinating. I mean, the rudest review I read was in The Independent, where the guy starts off by saying, "Now I remember why punk had to happen." And you know, you kind of understand that, but I think it had to happen for things that came just after that. You know, sacrilegiously, I might suggest anything from Dark Side of the Moon onwards was why punk had to happen, and I'm glad it did. But, you know, I'd rather listen to the Ramones than Dark Side of the Moon.
I've heard this record described as dinner party rock, which I think is quite... and we're going to come on to dad rock later on, but there's an element of this where people think, oh, this is a bit stoic, it's a bit familiar, and it's actually just an album made up of other things.
I guess I'd be more inclined to call it new age rock. You know, it's a bit kind of, you know, you could have the Crystals and the incense burning and groove on it, but it's also reminiscent to me of the fact that I do think at one time they were poised to be extraordinarily innovative, and they did do some stuff that was extraordinarily innovative in terms of long instrumentals that, to a large extent, you'd only ever heard in jazz before, and suddenly you were hearing it with electric guitar and organ. You know, I mean, the Grateful Dead were doing it as well, and the West Coast guys, but in Britain, the Floyd led the way on that. The first two occasions, or three occasions that I saw them, one, they brought a light show, and you'd never seen light shows, and these light shows were extraordinary. Second time I saw them was at the first free concert in Hyde Park, you know, where I seem to remember there were choirs and other bands and augmented things and so on. It was a beautiful summer's afternoon. Third time was 3 o'clock in the morning at the Bath Festival, when they finished it again with a great brass bands and orchestras and fireworks and stuff. And there was just stuff going on all the time that you thought, God, that's a good idea. That's an interesting idea. Just, you know, so on. And in the end, it all got a bit grandiose for me, and I stopped listening to them. But this cheered me up. I found it very pleasant. I have to say, it was a good soundtrack to type to. So, you know, maybe that condemns it with faint praise. But, you know, it didn't get in the way. Anyway, guys, it's your turn. I've said enough, probably.
There is something about this where, you know, there are moods, I think, to this record. There's an idea that it comes in four sides, I think. There's this kind of strange track listing where it's geared very much to the double LP, to the vinyl release, which is great to have the Pie and Vinyl folks in to be able to discuss that. It has been massively popular in terms of its pre-order. I think it's the most pre-ordered album on Amazon. It's sold over 100,000 copies before it's actually released. To give you a scale, to give you an indication, the Division Bell sold over 12 million copies as an album, which is massive, isn't it, as an album. But I came to this thinking, I like Pink Floyd. I've kind of grown up with Pink Floyd. And probably, you know, the kind of Gilmore Pink Floyd and the Roger Waters Pink Floyd. We'll discuss that in a minute because, you know, the furniture might start flying around, shall we say. But there's a link here in terms of, if you think of a classic, if I think of a classic Pink Floyd album, I think of Wish You Were Here. You know, that's a great album, okay? And that's about the passing of a band member. Not the death of a band member, but the kind of disappearance and kind of detachment, if you like, of one of their flock. This is the same territory. This is that kind of same reflective, something has passed, something has changed, something's very different. And there's also a suggestion that this is potentially the last ever Pink Floyd studio album. It's a kind of marker to say, this is it, we're done. There will be countless remasters, reissues, live things, all those kind of things. So, conscious of what Dave said about the kind of the release, you know, we're very limited in terms of the amount of time we've actually had to listen to this now, at this point in time. You guys have, I guess, got certain expectations or certain kind of ideas about what this looks like. Rad, let's start with you, because you've got a very personal connection, I think, to some of this.
Yeah, to a certain extent, you could say that. I mean, we've been selling it all day. I mean, obviously, like, you know, as with any other purveyor of music, we've been taking pre-orders on it for a few weeks now, and through our click and collect service, we've had people putting requests through for it, and yeah, we've had you know, I'd like to say an arrangement of different types of individual coming in for it today, but perhaps not.
And it's been flying out, has it? You've been kind of shifting a fair few.
It's Monday, it's new release day. You know, the amount of people that might come in on the day of an album being released varies, and the people coming in for this album today is not varying. You know, like it, in terms of it being personal for me, it's not personal for me. I mean, it's going to be personal for me because, like, my dad is absolutely obsessed with Pink Floyd. Like, I think some people never quite get over a certain band, you know, and for my dad, it was Pink Floyd. He never recovered from Pink Floyd. And I mean, his favourite album would probably be The Final Cut. But I can remember, I think we had Division Bell, that was reissued probably 2 months ago. 20th anniversary. So that would make me 11 when that album came out. And I can remember every single time we got in the car, that album was on, you know, so I know that album inside and out. So I haven't listened to it. Not this new record, you know, I have not listened to it at all. And I've done that very much on purpose. My dad's coming down in a fortnight to do the pre-Christmas shebang. And I've got a copy of the record. I pre-ordered it.
You're a good boy.
We're going to sit down and we're going to have a record listening party, the two of us. And yeah, it'll be nostalgic for him and emotional for me also, I suppose. You know, it's yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to it, to be honest.
And Steve, what about you in terms of Pink Floyd? You're more of a Beatles man, I know, but and is Pink Floyd someone that you kind of put on the deck now and again?
Yeah, I don't know, it's like a rites of passage, you know. I've got fond memories of digging in crates in North End when I was 15, and Dark Side of the Moon would be the album to look for, you know. It's almost like, certainly me growing up, you'd look for The Doors, you'd look for Dark Side of the Moon, you'd look for Beatles records, you'd look for Kinks records, you know. They were the kind of pinnacle artists that you try and get, and Dark Side of the Moon is probably their biggest.
Well, my argument, I think, really is that this is a kind of parallel piece. This isn't really a proper Pink Floyd studio album. It's in a kind of an accompaniment piece. But again, I'm a kind of a flag waver for Roger Waters, if you like.
And do you mean because Roger Waters is not on it?
Well, not completely.
Well,
but
let me just pick that up very briefly, because okay, yep. You know, somebody in my generation who remembers Pink Floyd before the album came out, even the first album, could make exactly the same argument and say the minute Syd Barrett left, that was it. There was no Pink Floyd. So, you know, you're going to struggle with that argument with it's like saying, well, once Brian Jones left the Rolling Stones, that wasn't the Rolling Stones. So, you know, a bass guitarist leaving a band, big deal.
I guess for me, though, you're right, and I agree with you, but I think for me, one of the issues was there was a kind of reformation of Pink Floyd, you know, particularly probably about 5-6 years ago. There was a coming together of those people, and there was a kind of, well, you know, do you know what? Some things, like global poverty and hunger, are more important than tit-for-tat fights in bands. And there was a kind of coming together, and I think there was a point at which, there was a juncture at which they could have quite easily made another album, or they could have, you know, entered into a kind of creative exchange, if you like. But they kind of decided not to do that. And I think that's, you know, there's some personal arrogance in that, if you like, but there's some back history, if you like. And I kind of think with this record, what's driving it, you know? And I think the answer to that is that there's a whole host of material that they wanted to use, and we know, certainly reading around this, that it was destined at one point to be a film soundtrack, but the only problem was there wasn't a film to use it as a soundtrack for. And we know that Pink Floyd are famous for coming out with reissues, remasters, kind of, you know, all kinds of different things. I think mainly fueled by some of the fantastic artwork that that they use. And this Endless River album is a good demonstration of that, because the artwork itself is fantastic, you know, the kind of the gondola or whatever he is on the cloud in the sky.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think for me, it's not, you're right that, you know, if a band member leaves, does that mean the band dies? Well, it doesn't always mean that. It means it's a different band. But I think it's striking on this that there's no inclusion of Roger Waters given his involvement and his importance in the early stage of the band.
Okay, but there's a long review in the Times last week, and Will Hodgkinson, the reviewer, refers to this issue, and he quotes Roger Waters as the former bassist stated with characteristic irritation, quotes, "I left Pink Floyd in 1985, that's 29 years ago." So I don't think it was their choice to exclude him. I think he, you know, I mean, there's no secret that I don't like Roger Waters, and I don't like what he did to Pink Floyd, and I'm no interest in his philosophies or his music or any of that. But that's just my opinion. Okay, that's nothing more than that. But I don't think there was any reason to take what they did here and try to re-include him. He's not missing, you know, because he's not the world's greatest bass player.
True.
I mean, what he was very influential in certain themes and stories and lyrics, which I don't like and other people do like. And that's why I'm saying, you know, it's no big deal that I don't like it. So he was very important in that. I can't see he would have brought anything to this largely spaced out instrumental project that would have changed anything. That would be my argument about his absence here. He's not missed any more than Bill Wyman is missed largely from the Rolling Stones, to be brutal. No. You know,
this has been described in some ways as a kind of an ambient album, which is an interesting description, and it is kind of, I suppose, classic kind of soundtrack Pink Floyd. I think, and you're right. You know, there are different phases of Pink Floyd.
I think every Pink Floyd fan and every fan of any band really has got they've got their own reasons for being a fan of that band. And you know, certainly with my dad, he's more Gilmore orientated, and I think he said something to me at some point or another that there was an air of mystique over the Pink and the Floyd and the Gilmore versus the Waters and stuff like that. And you know, post the Wall, a lot of fans were left curious as to who was who and what was what and who was responsible for that. But being a kind of Division Bell onwards listener, if you like, and that being mostly what I'm familiar with from Pink Floyd, the fact that it's a continuation of that, I shouldn't think when I listen to it, I'll think about any of that stuff, really.
It seems to me, from the outside, it's almost like a battle of wheels, you know. It's almost, to me, it is Gilmore versus Waters, and it seems like Nick Mason and David Gilmore almost want to draw a line under Pink Floyd, you know, pull the cover over its head, tuck it into bed and say goodnight, this is us done. And a nice way to do that is to dedicate it to Richard Wright. You know, you've got the emotions, you've got the heartstrings being pulled there. To me, again, it's not just because of my Jesus-like appearance. The artwork for me says a lot, you know. It's almost like a vision of heaven, or going into heaven, or perhaps, you know, what you perhaps would see when something passes, someone passes. But then you've got Roger Waters, who's constantly touring the Wall, won't draw that line under Pink Floyd, and he's clearly still making money from that name. So there's controversy with using Pink Floyd and publicly stating, I've got nothing to do with them anymore, but then going out on tour and getting millions of pounds from touring the Wall. So it seems to me a battle of wills. It's kind of Pink Floyd, this is the end, this is a nice little kind of ambient piece of music, this is us done.
The popular description has been this is their swan song, but you know, from talking earlier, you were saying that you know it's kind of not an end, and you know the title is endless, if you like. It kind of doesn't finish, and that's a kind of legacy thing.
I think Nick Mason was quoted recently as saying that on his gravestone, his epitaph will be, "I'm not sure if the band's finished yet."
Yeah.
Which seemed to me to be quite nice. There's one other observation I'd like to make about them. You know, I don't think there's any. You know, again, I'm not making any big claim about this in terms of, you know, oh, I was there at the beginning. Stuff, because that's just a matter of timing, you know. I just happen to be older than everybody else in this room and most people I meet these days. But it was interesting for me, I was just kind of checking out here, that there's a history of Pink Floyd in Portsmouth and of people from Portsmouth going to see them, which covers almost precisely a period of 5 years from their first live gig in Portsmouth to the gig in 1972 when they played the first complete version live of Dark Side of the Moon. And the interesting thing about that history is that it's Pink Floyd as a live band. But all we almost ever do now is talk about Pink Floyd as a studio band. And I think that transformation is not unlike the transformation that the Beatles went through. I mean, it's a much longer one. And I know that that stuff gets toured. I know that Waters tours the Wall, and they do sometimes, you know, go and play in great arenas. But the key point I would make is the first two gigs they did in Portsmouth in 1967 were in the Birdcage Mod Club, which was used to soul records and soul bands and so on. And they turned up with a light show and played twice to, I don't know, 200 people in a hall that was actually smaller than the Wedgwood Rooms, you know. The first gig at the Guildhall, I mean, this is a mind-boggling thought. Here's the first gig at the Guildhall. They do two houses because it's one of those 1960s package tours, right? So they're on at 6:30 and they're on at 8:50 again. And with them, Heir Apparent, who are not particularly well-known, The Move, Amen Corner, Jimi Hendrix.
Wow.
So they must have done quarter an hour each. You know, here's half of Careful with That Axe, Eugene, you know, and then off you get, you know, and get and warm up for the second half. I mean, it must have been, I know people who went to it, I didn't go to that, but, you know, it must have been an extraordinary thing.
The Endless River, Pink Floyd's attempt at a 21st century album, is available now on Parlophone Records, pretty much everywhere, but I would recommend at Pine Vinyl.
Definitely.
We move now to art. Earlier on this month, I caught up with local artist Carl Rudziak to find out what he's up to locally and his intriguing new projects. Carl, welcome. to Towards the Point.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Now, I've described you as an artist, but let's delve into that a bit. What kind of things are you doing?
I'm a portrait artist, I guess, or figurative artist. I like painting people, to put it in a nutshell. It's really an extension of me. It's my engagement with the environment and the people I meet, either where I live, family, friends, people I know. They're the easiest ones to paint. People I don't know so well, like, say, someone who works in a local shop or someone I've got to know down the pub, who tells me an interesting story, and I scratch my head, oh, that could be an interesting picture. And my wife came back talking about a work colleague, about the way she dressed and about these, you know, great clothes and the personality, and I said, I want to meet her. She sounds great, and I did. And Yvonne is one of my pictures.
So you're a local lad.
Yeah.
You're from Portsmouth, born and bred.
No, born in Newbury.
In Newbury.
But mum and dad came down when I was 6 months old, so bred.
Okay, I think that kind of counts.
I think it counts.
It's near enough.
Humpy boy.
You've got the Berkshire connection if you need it.
Yeah, I've never needed it though.
So tell me about how you became an artist. Obviously, was it something you kind of went through formal education and picked up?
Well, I could always draw. Since I picked up a pencil, you could say it's innate, but I don't believe that. I believe that I liked drawing, but I just drew a lot, and I kept drawing and kept drawing. Yeah, I went to art college, did a foundation in the 80s, came out. I did a foundation at Portsmouth College of Art before it became university, and then I did jewellery design. And then I left it, went to work with Dad, block paving.
Natural progression.
Absolutely, a natural progression. Jewellery design to block paving, so I went out there on the sites and just to make some money, really.
It's shapes and symmetry in some way, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Not the way I saw it. Sort of back-breaking hard work, that's what it was. But I made some good dosh, and I bought, I was playing in a band at the time, so I just generally had a good life. And then I got to my 30s, and I thought, oh my God, you know, I'm 30 now, better do something. Went back to university, and then I did a degree in communications design.
And did you find that kind of formal education, the structure of education, restrictive, or was it a liberation for you?
It was really going back to university in Portsmouth University, and the course at the time was very much involved with theory and practice, and that really defined me. It shaped my mindset into the way I think now about critical engagement, cultural engagement. And so that course was structured that you made it your own, but yeah, theory and practice, not the practice of theory, I think it was the way they pushed that forward at the time.
And in terms of what you produce, I'm going to be careful here, but what you do produce in terms of your painting is quite accessible in the sense that you know, it's not abstract.
No.
And it's not designed, it's not designed initially to throw people or...
No.
To get them kind of trying to figure out what it is.
No,
it's accessible in the sense that it's recognisable and immediate.
Yes,
there's a lot of layers to it.
Absolutely, accessibility is a key thing because I believe art should be accessible. I'm one of my favourite artists, Damien Hirst, and I talk about concept work and about throwing, you know, with a thousand years. It's a fantastic piece, but essentially that's a rotting head with flies that are born on this rotting head, go into the next room and get. You know, and die essentially, get zapped by a fly zapper. To me, that's a life cycle. I'm watching something being born and die, and to me, that's just a gorgeous, a wonderful thing to look at. So it's not just about surface, but I think that my work has to be accessible, and that's a key word, so they can engage on their own terms, so people can engage on their own terms. You don't need a specific art language to make a comment, because everyone can draw. Everyone can draw properly or you know, well, but they know how to draw. They know the action of drawing, you know.
But there's not an overt controversy about some of your work, or maybe not an immediate one.
No. The John Westwood picture would be the biggest controversy had.
For folks that don't know that, just explain to us, just tell us what that is.
Well, John Portsmouth Football Club Westwood, for those who don't go to the football or are not fans of the football, he is Portsmouth Football Club's number one fan, and I can say that without any sense of contradiction. He wears a big, tall, checkered, blue and white checkered hat with a checkered waistcoat, checkered shorts and big flappy boots. He bangs a big drum at every game. Now the fans know him, and he is a massive character and a controversial character because some fans like him. I think he's just a prime example of passion and his passion taking over identity. And I mean, he's covered in tattoos, and his identity, he said himself, it is Portsmouth Football Club. We've had this conversation. And so he, you know, some say he's not a great example for children, but actually the kids love him as well. You know, they do. They kind of see that kind of clown-like thing. But so there is a kind of something happening there that he has this clown appearance, but that clown appearance really masks this deep, deep-rooted passion, which, you know, it's kind of mutated itself really into what is John. And not only that, I mean, when the it got displayed in the National Portrait Gallery as part of the BP Awards, it went on tour. And the first place it went on tour was Southampton City Art Gallery.
Popular choice.
Absolutely. And I didn't know at the time. And that the Southampton fans didn't like that, as you could expect. So a few social network comments popped up on the Echo.
You've got to have them.
Well, yeah, so that's the nearest it got. And we talked about security and that sort of thing. I said, no. It's part of the story of the piece. And that's what I try to do, is get a story behind who I paint.
Is it fair to say that that portrait is possibly one of your most well-known pieces?
People see your name, that's what they associate me with.
And I think it's a great painting. I've seen it kind of in situ, and it's frightening in some ways, but challenging, I think.
Yeah.
And I say it's frightening because I think to an extent it kind of personifies what you do, or literally personifies what you do, but there's a kind of tribal
Yes, absolutely.
And you talk about, certainly in through website and in other places, you talk about kind of markers and identity. Mm. And that's really important, isn't it? And it's about, I think, tribes that people belong to, consciously or not.
All the symbols we wear, all the clothes we wear, the way we cut our hair, the music we like, they're all symbols, aren't they? They're all stamps of our identity. And by looking at the way that people dress, you start to project your ideals onto them based on what you know.
Mm.
And so and very often we get that wrong, you know. And another example, I mean, John, that picture is a mutation of all of that, if you think. It's how the passion can push it so far forward, so out of sync. It's, you know, and to me, Portsmouth was kind of like that for a bit. So he kind of symbolised Portsmouth, you know, the whole of the city in a way, you know, at some stage. But Scary Guy's another picture that, you know, people look at him, and he's a classic example of that. You know, he's like a world peace activist. You know, he does seminars on bullying and all sorts, but yet you look at him, you think he's straight out of prison.
There is that thing, isn't there, about challenging assumption and prejudice and stereotype.
Yes.
And I think what you do well is you use that as a palette, but against itself almost. You know,
I hope that what I do raises an area of debate. And so by looking at my portraits, my paintings, then it kind of, hopefully it echoes back. For instance, I did an exhibition where I didn't put any information about the person underneath the picture. I just called the picture by the job title, the physiotherapist, the local government officer, etc.
Mm-hmm.
No information. That's the only, because we often say, you know, if we meet people for the first time, party or dinner party, it's the first question very often is, and what do you do? So it's like, we're defined by our jobs, are we?
And so
that, little tricks like that, a little party trick, I guess, will raise that debate and ask, and you have to start asking those questions. Well, who is this person then? And, you know, you think you know them because of the clothes they wear, but Yvonne is a local government officer, but she was wearing, you know, she has a big bright yellow dress and red tights and very loud, and it's totally against the grain of what you think of an officer would wear, you know, powerful shield, dark clothes or whatever, very somber. So it's really, you're absolutely right, challenging assumptions and stereotypes.
Let's talk about some of your recent exhibitions, because you've recently had a range of work exhibiting at the Guildhall, in Portsmouth Guildhall.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the BP, more kind of national, kind of touring exhibition.
Yeah, the BP Awards is an annual exhibition run by the National Portrait Gallery in London. John made it to the 2009 Final 50, so it's a finalist. And then on the back of that, I got offered exhibitions. One of them is Life the Gallery in Farnham, where I started the Zodiac exhibition. That was a identity, but the previous one was called Perceptions, and that was about what we just talked about stereotyping, about projecting ideas onto other people, just simply by the way they look, or the way they sit, the way they dress, their hairstyles, etc. I extended that to identity in the Zodiac Gallery down at the Guild Hall last year, 2013, October. And that was really about, okay, it was about me connecting with my environment. And identity is about, you know, I paint people as a reaction to my environment. You know, like I said before, it's people I know, people I find interesting. But that's an attempt to just look a little further and look at the city at large, and that's where I began to do that. And it's where I began to do this current project, which I'll talk about in a minute, by putting out a questionnaire and asking, who would you think I could paint? Who would you like to be seen painted, perhaps put on a portrait, and why? And do you think that the arts has any value in Portsmouth? So that was last year, and so now I'm starting another project, which really starts with the question, do you know anybody that doesn't think art or culture has any value in the city? Mm. And those are the people I want to target.
So you're kind of crowdsourcing that, aren't you? You said a questionnaire.
Yeah.
I think the modern parlance, shall we say, is crowdsourcing. You're kind of saying to people, what do you like, what don't you like, what should this be, who should we approach, who should we...
Well, as usual with these projects, it starts with a key pivotal moment, and this moment started down the pub, as some of them do. I was just chatting away, and some guy said to me, "Oh, you're the bloke that painted that Johnny Westwood picture." So yes, I am. And what'd you do that for? So, well, it's won the FA Cup. I thought it was a good idea. You know, yeah, but he's a bit of a, you know, he's not. Well, I won't say the words, but yep. So, well, no, he's an interesting marker, though. Don't you think that we need culture and art in the city? And I'm just trying to say, no, we don't need culture. So, well, we are all part culture. No, no, you've got a footy, you've got a navy, you don't need all that. So, and I thought, I wonder how many other people think like this.
Is that, do you think, because people, you know, people will put culture in the kind of classical music, radio for fine art, the Turners, if you like, well, put it in that bracket.
You have to look at culture, don't you? You've got high culture, you've got low culture, low brow, mid brow, high brow. And I think he, you know, he just assumed I was talking high brow culture because I'm an artist and I paint, and so my domain is only in highbrow, high culture.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to say that, well, no, it's not. You know, culture's culture. For me, it's high, low. You know, I guess where I start is I'm kind of middle, aren't I? You know, accessibility is kind of like maybe sort of like middle brow. You know, it's accessible, like you said earlier. And what I try and do is take the journey from middle to high, maybe, just to make that engagement. Obviously, I don't want to dumb down or anything. You know, I want to engage people at their own pace, at their own level, at their, you know, their own engagement. And so so maybe the what I'm trying to do is just take that journey a little higher and pull people a little higher into the higher realms. And it's not that scary, and it's really not that hard to do. All it means, and all you have to do is just ask questions and debate it and put your point of view across.
It's quite crafty, I think, if you don't mind me saying so, because what you're saying is, effectively, you're saying folks perhaps don't have an understanding of what culture could be.
Yeah.
But in having that dialogue, having that conversation, you're drawing them into it and saying, well, help me define what it is.
Yes, in a sense, yes, because I think there's an assumption, again, we assume so much that culture is all high... When you say the word culture to some people, it's like... Ah, it's just all that Ponzi stuff.
Yeah.
It's not, you know. I mean, I don't listen to opera. I don't listen to a lot of classical music, the old Gregorian chant now and again, you know. But basically, I'm an AC/DC fan. You know? I like ZZ Top. Things that just grab me emotively, and I think we're all like that. And that is, to me, it's all cultural. So maybe just bring the word culture and make it more accessible, I think.
So this project, We Don't Need Culture, which is how you're kind of branding it, how are you starting to get people engaged in that, involved in that?
Essentially, I've got to get the message out there.
Because it's a tough job.
Yeah. What I want to do, what I want to do is paint, I think, a cross-section of the people of Portsmouth. Some people who are into the arts, you know, I don't want to exclude them. You know, this is not about... excluding anybody. This is about people who are well-to-do, who are successful. I think they ought to be included too.
The hats and cravats, I think you should bracket them.
And also, but really, I think people who wouldn't go to art galleries, wouldn't be bothered, wouldn't see it as any value, wouldn't get any, don't think they wouldn't get any value out of it because they haven't been. Now, I do some projects in schools, and simply just standing up and painting in front of the students has an effect. You can see the process because they've never been exposed to that sort of thing. So anything new, I think, has got to be a good thing. Now, you might come away from it hating it, but I've got a feeling that I think some people might like it more than they'd admit. And they're the kind of people I'd like to sort of get to. And you've got, 200,000 people in this city. And I bet there's a few of them out there that think that, it's not for us, this culture thing. But culture can lead to business growth. It can lead to growth. So it has a practical, it can have a practical outcome.
I think it's provocative and it's dangerous, and therefore it must be a good thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, I want 50 pictures, and I need subjects, and specifically subjects that, if you're in an art class or you're into art, but maybe your wife, your husband, boyfriend, girlfriend, whoever, so no, it's difficult, I'll come, but it'd be difficult dragging my boyfriend along, he's not into all that. So, bring him along anyway, you'll be surprised. If you just drag him along, get him in there, and more often than not, they'll go, actually, that was... it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. So they're the kind of people I want to get to. So spread the word, so to speak.
I think putting it across in that way is massively helpful because one of the failings, I think, of certainly art culture, if you like, is it's very pompous in terms of how it tries to kind of get across to people.
Yeah.
So you put it across in a very eloquent man-in-the-street fashion.
Thank you very much.
That is a compliment, hopefully. Just to wrap up, if folks are interested in your work and the things that you're up to, you've got a website.
I have.
Which I'm just looking for the address. Is rudziak.co.uk. Yes. Just to spell that for folks, just to be clear, it's RUDZIAK. So you can find that. We'll put links to your site on our blog.
Fantastic.
And Carl, it's been a pleasure to get you in.
Get them to email me as well. I mean, I'll put my email address on there. And if they come up with any ideas, just or on my Facebook page. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter. I've got a Twitter account as well.
He's everywhere.
I forget all that. It's everywhere. Yeah, I'll be over this, all over the city like a cheap suit.
We'll do that. Carl, thanks very much.
Thanks
for your time. You are listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, Dave Allen, and Steve and Rad from Pie and Vinyl. And we're talking about rock, but specifically dad rock. Now, this is a confusing descriptor, and when we've got a confusing descriptor, we need the arch intelligence of Dave Allen. Dave, explain this. Where's this coming from?
Well, I think I first came across it in an article in the Daily Telegraph, which in itself makes me laugh, really, because I grew up as a pop fan in the 60s with a dad who wasn't into any kind of rock at all and took the Daily Telegraph. And one of the reasons he would have liked the Daily Telegraph is that they never wrote about rock music, whereas now they're writing about this stuff. Now, we've made the point in conversation that it's clearly not a genre as such, that what we're talking about are, I think, two distinct things. One is tweaked reissues. For example, Led Zeppelin 4, I think, has just been tweaked and brought out again, for probably about the 17th time, I don't know. But and also, crucially perhaps, artists from way back in the 70s and 60s who were producing new albums. And we've already talked about Pink Floyd, which is kind of a new album, although it's reworking old material. But I have in front of me the latest copy of Uncut magazine, just because it's a useful thing. And it's got references to two Bob Dylan albums. One is this repackaging of the 1967-68 Basement Tapes. And the other then is a set of lyrics that he provided for somebody else to rework, people like Elvis Costello and so on, called Lost on the River, the new Basement Tapes. So there are kind of two Bob Dylan albums, one of which has got 138 tracks on. And then there's the Pink Floyd that we talked about earlier. Then there's a new Brian Ferry album called Avonmore, whatever that means, or could be Evermore perhaps. And then there's a new Neil Diamond album. And then there's a, now I'm particularly fond of this, there's a new Gong album, which of course features David Allen, so I'm very fond of that. And then something that you're very fond of, Neil Young's new album, Storytone, U2's Songs of Innocence, which they insist on giving to everybody, Richard Thompson and his family, various artists, The Art of McCartney, Robin Williamson from the Incredible String Band, and finally, one of my great favourites, Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band, Sun Zoom Spark, 1970 to 1972. But that's just a flavour, you know, and it's middle of November. And so what they're hoping, I guess, is that lots of 16-year-olds are going to walk into Pine Vinyl and say, I need three albums for my dad for Christmas, and I'm going to buy blah, 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 or whatever. So I suppose, guys, my question is, artistically, do we think this is a great idea, or should these people shuffle off and give youngsters a, you know, that's one question, all right? You can have 3 minutes on that one. But I'm more interested, really, in what you find happening. You know, is there now, you know, a client group that's coming in for that kind of stuff that really isn't coming in for the cutting-edge, brand-new artists and so on? And is that a good idea in terms of the record retail industry?
Yeah, I mean, there really is, to the point where we have recently segregated our record collection into our new current artists and our classics and reissued artists. It's very clear. There's just so much music being released now, as you've just highlighted. Mm.
So that's interesting. So what, in terms of the segregation, what's the line? What's the history line? Where does it start being current?
I was going to say it's not just your classic artists. You know, we had a Universal rep visit us probably about a month ago to talk through their Christmas offerings. I thought it was Groundhog Day, you know. It was ABBA reissues, The Jam, The Who, The Beatles, and he showed me this kind of montage that they put together for their customers. And yeah, it's the same thing you've seen, you know, and they always seem to start with the ding, it's been a hard, and as soon as you hear that, you kind of, a little warm feeling comes out of somewhere, and then it's quickly shot dead. It's certainly got its place, and with the whole vinyl resurgence and the fact that vinyl was kind of taken away from the customer, and the reason vinyl died was because people couldn't buy it, not because nobody wanted to. Obviously, there was the emphasis on the CD. Was it all just a big marketing plan, a big marketing ploy? Because our customers come in, as Dave said, you know, Led Zeppelin are the latest, you know, supreme big artists to reissue on 1, 2, 3. And then wait 3 months and then do 4 or 5 Houses of the Holy. You know, remastered by Jimmy Page. It's got a couple of unreleased tracks, some concert footage from Paris. But these people that are buying them have bought it back in the day when, granted, the vinyl was a bit thinner. Probably bought it on cassette tape, probably bought it on CD, probably bought it in some other format or various guise. Yeah. And now they're buying it again because their first record's too old and, you know, you can't hear it properly anymore. You can understand the logic why the record companies are doing it, whether it's healthy or not. Again, it's a really tough one. We're focusing on the classic artists, but let's not forget quite credible indie bands. Sleater-Kinney, for example, they've released a box set very recently. Jesus and Mary Chain, they're back together, they're touring next year. Slow Dive,
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Nick Cave's always around. So there's a lot of artists that come back, and you could argue they're due their payday, you know, and that's essentially what the whole thing is about. So they're coming back, they're touring, they're getting the recognition they arguably deserve, they're getting the chance to release their records. How is that impacting the 14-year-old at home thinking, I'm going to start a band? It's all a time machine, isn't it? You can travel back to 1960 and you can fast forward to 1992 like that. Is that a great thing or is it not? Probably a great thing.
It's always kind of been, like, your classic albums have always been big business, and, you know, when it comes to distributors and record companies constantly making sure the shelves are full of them, you know, various different music shops I've worked in over the years, they've always been very important to people that run those shops, you know. It's kind of a staple. I mean, with Pine Vinyl, you know, we've got an arrangement of different customers that come in, you know, a full spectrum of human beings that walk through our doors, and some people will come in and they'll go straight for Hookworms, you know, which has come out today. To me, that's the biggest album for this week. They've gone straight for that. That's what they want. Other people won't get that far. And you know, we've packaged up like you know, the nostalgic, the memorabilia that they need from their youth, and placed it right in front of you know, the door, so that there it is. They can just snatch it out when they're ready for it.
But one of my perspectives on that is that the first album that I ever bought came out in, I think, something like March to May 63. It was the first Beatles album, Please Please Me. Now, the interesting thing in those days is that there wasn't much choice. And classic albums, at best, only went back about 10 years. So it would have been something like Songs for Swinging Lovers by Frank Sinatra, which would have been a completely, you know, I wouldn't have wanted that. You know, I would now.
We've
now,
got
you
both
know.
Of those in the classic influential hush.
Right. Well, now I do, you see. But what's fascinating is the extent to which, and it was the same with singles in those days, there wasn't that much choice, actually, you know, until the sort of mid-60s and the kind of soul import stuff began to come in. You essentially pick which top 40 hits you liked, or which top 40 albums you liked, because that was all there was, you know. Did you like Buddy Holly, or did you like Chuck Berry? And that was kind of it. But now there's a history, isn't there? You know, there's 60 years of it now from Elvis Presley's first recording. 60 years worth of, yeah, even if we exclude dance bands and jazz and all the rest of that, if we say that, you know, modern rock music at least started in 1954, 60 years worth of stuff, and finding your way through that is... It's very... I've given up with new stuff, you see. It's not... I just kind of feel like my brain can't take it. And I keep thinking, I bet I'm missing some really lovely things here. Mm. You know,
see, it's really hard. The amount of music released nowadays for a so-called dying industry, you know, every Monday there's 30-plus new releases. That's not including the reissues either.
Are you having to pick and choose whether you take things or not? I mean, would you take the new Neil Diamond album, for example? It doesn't feel like a Pine Vinyl album.
It's so funny, isn't it? It's a real sort of juxtaposition, I guess. And this sounds ridiculous. We wouldn't take the Neil Diamond album because it's only released on CD. You know, we'd take it, probably, if it was released on vinyl, we'd have a representation of it in the shop.
Okay. There's a question here for me about, you know, and it links to what we were talking about earlier and the new Pink Floyd album. It's the kind of, it's this, there's a junction here at which it's either reinvention or recycling, you know, and I'm not quite sure which. So to take two examples. One is the new David Bowie compendium, as it's being called, which has a new track wedged into it. So the majority of Bowie fans will have all of those songs already, okay? They might not have them in the remastered way or the new version that they've released them, but it's that key new song that they want to own. Now, obviously, they could download that, but it's presented in such a way where it's attractive to have the whole thing together. The other interesting example is the Queen reissue. I don't know if you've picked up on this. Queen have gone back to some early vocals laid down by the late Freddie Mercury and worked them up into new tracks and added them onto historic stuff that, again, is a back catalogue. So that's kind of... Is that recycling stuff, or is it reinventing from previous stock? That's a kind of open question. I mean, not an easy one.
The funny thing about David Bowie, I mean, I love David Bowie, but my general experience of David Bowie fans is it doesn't matter whether they own those tracks already or not. Even if there wasn't a brand new David Bowie song wedged in the middle, they'd be buying that record anyway.
I was telling you earlier, I think it may be partly that my generation, which is a lot more than 40 plus, I have to say, but that really grew up with vinyl, that what we did was get rid of the machinery. And we bought in, I bought top-end Bose CD, multiplayers, and I'm thinking, I just spent hundreds of pounds on that, and I've got all these CD racks, and I've got my computer with iTunes on it. Am I now going to go and buy another record? Well, I did go and buy another record player, and actually, it's not a very good one. But I think a lot of my generation are just saying, no, I'm not going to go and buy any more technology. I'm just sick of, but here's an interesting thing in terms of who you might be selling to. This was a piece in The Observer yesterday. Every year, the number of people over 64, that's me, in the UK is increasing 10 times faster than the number of people between 15 and 64. Some of my contemporaries are not very well off, but it is a myth that pensioners don't have any money. Some pensioners have got enough money. You know, I'm just an old age pensioner, so the government is about to start giving me, some hundreds of pounds a month more than I was getting last month, most of which I shall go and spend in Pie and Vinyl, you know. Well, that is going to be You know, there is going to be that group of people who are going to be interested in spending money on those kinds of things.
Yeah,
you know, and they are, we are, my generation, you know, are big consumers of it because we grew up with it in a way that my parents didn't. You know, I mean, you know, I mean, my dad, you know, when he was, you know, teenage 20s, went through the Depression, didn't always have employment and so on. 10 years after that, he's in the war for 6 years. Then he's married with kids and getting a mortgage. There was never a point at which he was thinking, oh, I can spend 100 quid a month on albums. Never, you know, even though his dad had sold records in the 30s, 78, you know, in Portsmouth. Never a moment where he could do that. So the best he could ever do was the radio. But my generation likes to own those things as your generations do, you know. Mm. And there's a lot of us out there and we are likely to spend money.
Dad rock for me means it's the flogging of the dead horse.
Right.
It's when an artist, in my opinion, is recycling stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and that is dad rock for me. The separation from that is where an artist will move forward and take it on, change the game. And that's, you know, that's the difference. And I think if with like things revolving the way that they do, you mentioned Psych earlier on, you mentioned like early Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
That's very much current. Yeah. That's very much relevant right now. But I think artists, contemporary Psych, rock artists are pushing it a bit further than that's the separation.
James is I'm not any longer a huge fan of Neil Young, but you are, but I do admire the fact that he tries to do that, you never know what's coming with him, and I think that's to be greatly admired. You like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, his new album is very mixed. I think it's got very mixed receptions. You know, it's kind of, he's taken a 90s six-piece orchestra or something and just basically recorded songs that he's written and wanted to record. But he's also released a deluxe version, because, you know, that's the way of things, isn't it?
With the orchestra.
Him doing solo versions of the songs, with just him and the guitar or him and the piano. And that's a whole different album. It's a really interesting experiment.
Yes, I got confused by the labelling there, because I thought the deluxe one was going to have the big orchestra on, but it was the other way round.
That's right.
And I couldn't figure that really.
It's been subversive for a
while. I see.
Well, there's some big thinking there, I think, for the pre-Christmas period. And all I will say to end that debate is, dad rock is already dead. Long live rad rock.
Yeah.
Just before we go, we've just got time to catch up with a few local events in and around Portsmouth. On the 30th of November, you can catch the Ting Tings playing live at the Wedgwood Rooms in Southsea. Tickets are available £15. You can call the box office on 023 9286 3911.
I'm going to mention my sister, Lily Allen. No, I'm only kidding. But she does have local connections. I think her little brother Alfie, about whom she once sung, went to school in Portsmouth. And she's on next Sunday at the Guildhall, and she's one of my favourite contemporary pop singers. I like her. And I've got two books to mention. Funny Girl by Nick Hornby is just out and getting good reviews. I haven't read it. But I have read Grayson Perry, who was once a Portsmouth art student, of course, and has written a really fabulous book about making sense of art called Playing to the Gallery. And if you wanted to read one book that talks a lot of sense about understanding art without being the least bit pretentious or difficult, that's the book for you.
The Christmas list is growing as we speak. Steve, you've got some stuff coming up.
Yeah, we've got a couple of shows to get you in the festive mood. On the 7th of December, we have got a Christmas show at the Square Tower in Old Portsmouth. It's always a huge pleasure to put on any event there. We've got the Retrospective Soundtrack Players. They are going to be playing their album in full, their brand new album called It's a Wonderful Christmas Carol. If you didn't know about the Retrospective Soundtrack Players, they are exactly that. They write soundtracks retrospectively, so their last couple of projects were A Cool Hand Luke and A Catcher in the Rye. So yeah, they are going to be premiering. It's one of our label releases. We've joint released it with Extra Mile Recordings, quite a big label, so we're hanging on to the coattails of that, which makes me think of Scrooge hanging on to his coattails. So we've got that on the 7th of December. There's tickets available in the shop and online. On the 17th of December, we've got a Presents record label show just at the Fat Fox in Albert Road. We've got Chichester's local Noisenik's Trams, who are signed to Fat Cat, playing for us, as well as our label acts Ricky Fitz and The Boy I Used to Be. They're both going to be playing their new bits and both have EPs out shortly after Christmas. So £4 entry. Again, tickets available from the shop. Bargains. We've got a couple of in-stores. We've got the Moulettes. They're playing on the 4th of December in the shop, and Beans on Toast on the 9th of December before he plays at the Wedge of Rooms. plus a few more hopefully to be announced. So they're completely free. Come into the shop and witness some fine live music.
Excellent stuff indeed. And also on the 30th of November, a popular day, you can go along to Portsmouth City Museum and hear a talk on Portsmouth during the Blitz. That's at 2:30 in the afternoon. That's just about it from this show. My thanks as ever to Dave Allen for his wisdom, and my thanks also to Steve and Rad for coming in and making more sense of some nonsensical sense.
Pleasure, thank you.
Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.